Every year, about 1.5 million children deal with the divorce of their parents. Even more are effective when you consider parental relationships that are not part of legal marriages that end. And the challenge, of course, is not for the parents to keep the needs and feelings of the children in the forefront, and that is a challenge, even when they're angry or grieving the loss of their partnership. And we're happy to have Karen Bonnell with us today. She is the author of The Co-Parent's Handbook, Raising Well-Adjusted, Resilient, and Resourceful Kids in a Two-Home Family, from Little Ones to Young Adults. Her private practice is dedicated to working with couples across the spectrum, from premarital preparation to co-parenting in two-home families to remarriage. Great to have her along, and certainly hoping you'll join in the conversation. Are you in a co-parenting situation? What's worked for you, or what hasn't been very successful? Maybe you were raised by co-parents. We'd love to get your insight into what worked and what didn't. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Karen Bonnell, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, Larry, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you know, the need for two parents to share a child after a separation or a divorce is certainly not new, but the term co-parenting, I think, is fairly recent. Maybe you could expand on what that means.
Well, that's interesting. I guess it's been so much a part of my vocabulary for a while, I didn't even realize it was new anymore. But what it means, actually, is any two parents who are raising children together, and what we've discovered is whether that's in one home or two, are actually co-parenting. As we become a culture and we become groups that parent differently than we did, say, in the 1950s, that the idea of co-parenting is that there's a little bit more of an egalitarian, a little bit more of a mutuality. There's a little bit more shared integration about how we parent often in our families these days. And so it was natural to think about, as we move into two homes, we really do need to take those skills and sharpen them so that for our children, anyway, their lives are integrated and moving forward, and they can return to the business of being children, which, of course, is growing up and strengthening and preparing for adulthood. So we call that co-parenting.
Yeah, and you make a point of saying that these ideas and the principles you talk about apply to pretty much all types of families. Well, you know, it's same sex or opposite sex, or it's a case of divorce or separation or never having been married.
That's exactly right. We're really talking about two adults who have committed to creating an environment that's best for children and want to raise them as the child's two parents. And clearly, there are often other adults who might be in that mix. There could be step-parents as well, or there could be a surrogate mom for someone who has had a child that's being raised by two men or two other women. We really make space for whatever definition of family is appropriate for your situation. It's our goal not to define family, but to support family and to provide principles and practices and protocols that actually make that job work.
Yeah.
And work for who? Work for both the co-parents, but particularly for those kiddos who are just busy growing up.
And we also want to make a point to say that there are certainly circumstances like a violent relationship or being compromised by addiction. Those kind of fall outside the recommendations that we're going to be talking about today, I think.
You know, that's true. However, there are many things in the book, even if we are having to pause in a typical form of co-parenting while somebody gets the treatment that they need, whether that be for addiction, whether that be for anger or domestic violence perpetration or incarceration or any number of things that kind of put us outside, you know, one or two standard deviations from the mean. You know, Larry, there are still principles in the book that say, hey, here's how you remember that half of your child's heart belongs to one parent and half of your child's heart belongs to the other. So how do we talk about that parent who has these needs, who must be in this treatment in order to be able to step back into parenting or whatever the situation may be? There's still some guidance there, even for those family situations that are more troubled.
There's a lot to talk about what you cover in your book. And again, I was just to mention the title, The Co-Parents Handbook, Raising Well-Adjusted, Resilient, and Resourceful Kids in a Two-Home Family, from Little Ones to Young Adults. I think the point that you come back to again and again is that this arrangement has to keep the child and his or her needs really as the focus and motivation.
Yeah, we call that keeping the child central without letting them get caught in the middle. And what happens when parents often, when they're first separating and divorcing, the trauma, the emotional trauma for one or both parents can be so great that at least momentarily they're sort of taken offline. It makes it really difficult to parent when you yourself feel emotionally devastated. And so we start right off at the beginning talking about what do you do when you're in a most uncertain situation. You might be scared. We actually call it being lost in the woods. And we walk parents to the example of what happens. You're out hiking with your kids, and you get lost in the woods. I mean, you're on your way to the lake, and there is no lake, and you've been hiking much longer than you should have, and you have no idea where you are. That's often how it feels in those early months of separation and divorce, before decisions have been made, before you understand your financial future, even before you understand how you'll share your children with their other parents. And what we say in the book is, you know, the last thing you would do is start expounding on the danger of bears, right?
Yeah.
Or starving to death. No, we kind of dig down to the bottom of our toes, even in the face of that uncertainty and our own fears and confusion and questions, and we might even want to turn to someone and blame them for getting us lost, but that's not the point, right? The point is we dig down to the bottom of our feet and we find confidence. We find confidence that says, you know what, we're going to be okay. We've got food and snacks and water, and people know we're hiking up here, and someone's going to help us get found, or we're going to figure out how to get back. And that's what we begin to teach parents, even in the face of all of the emotional upheaval and all of the uncertainty, is how do you become a confident guide for your children, even when you don't know the answers?
Yeah, sort of you mentioned parent mind versus spouse mind.
Correct.
I think you were kind of giving almost an example there.
Right. Well, exactly. So, you know, we were in a one-home family, and we're just parenting, and we're spouses, we tend to put those roles almost like one, because, of course, we're one person. So we think of ourselves as, like for me, I was a wife and mother, and I didn't try and separate those two roles. And yet, when it comes to divorce and separation, we want to remember that it's spouses who are divorcing. Parents aren't divorcing kids, and kids aren't divorcing anyone. And that's a really critical understanding as we start to uncouple what needs to be uncoupled while simultaneously rebuilding or strengthening a co-parenting relationship. So when we talk about spouse mind or intimate partner mind, we're talking about all the feelings I might have toward you, Larry, for failing me as a spouse. I can have all kinds of thoughts about that and feelings that follow that, but that have nothing to do with you as maybe a dad to our children. And the look on our kids' face when you show up at their soccer game or as they pack and get ready to go to your house, that's my parent mind. My parent mind remembers that both of us are really, really important to our children's overall well-being, and I want that for them. As mad as I might be at you, what I want for them is a good relationship with both their parents, because that's what kids need.
Yeah, they sure do. You use many good examples. I love the examples you use in your book. It's sort of situations that you talk about.
Well, you know, after years of doing this, now, of course, all of the vignettes and stories in the book of real families are not of any one real family. We were very, very careful. And of course, none of the names are the same. Our intention, Kristen Little, my contributing author, and I, our intention there was to really provide families with real life examples. And I suspect that there's not a co-parent who would look at those vignettes and go, oh, yeah, part of that's my story. Oh, yeah. Oh, part of that's my story. And I have to joke that I say to my own children, I said, okay, so you're Jeffrey on page 63, and to my daughter, and you're Madeline on page 104. You know, so, and of course they laugh, but that gives parents a sense of normalcy about, wow, these challenges are not just unique to us. Of course, our family situation is unique.
And at that point, at this point, we need to take a quick break, Karen. We'll be back. We'll let you finish that thought right after this look at the news. Stay with us. More than half of all marriages end in divorce, and the percentage I can think about is even higher when you factor in long-term committed relationships that end. And certainly children are often involved in these families' disillusion. And the job of the parents is to make sure that the children have all the support and love they need from both parents. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network for this important discussion with Karen Bonnell, who is the author of Co-Parents Handbook, Raising Well-Adjusted, Resilient, and Resourceful Kids in a Two-Family Home. From little ones to young adults. Now, her private practice is dedicated to working with couples across the spectrum, from premarital preparation to co-parenting in two home families to remarriage. And Karen, thanks again for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Larry. And it's just such a an important conversation, because what happens, you know, what separation and divorce takes apart for children, it's skillful co-parenting rebuilds. And so that's what we're hoping to help parents with. How do we build that strong sense of family for children when a family change has to occur? Then how do we do that in the most skillful way possible?
We have Marcus from Appleton online. By the way, if you'd like to join in with your own experience to share or a question, I hope you will at 1-800-642-1234. Sometimes people don't like to talk about this, and in those cases, once in a while, maybe an email or something on my Facebook page. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Marcus in Appleton, thanks for calling. And what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to kind of share my own experience, try to briefly talk about what happened. When I was a kid, my parents got divorced, and for quite a while it was a fight over who got the kids and under what conditions and that sort of thing, which ultimately led to my mother leaving the state, and it was nearly 10 years that I didn't see her or hear from her, speak to her in any way, shape, or form. And at the time, it led to me feeling like I kind of shut down, didn't care. It was easier to be angry at her than to be sad and to miss her. And at the time, I felt that that was the best for me because it was easier emotionally. But now as an adult, I'm 27 years old, and I'm finding over the years that I now have problems becoming emotionally attached to people, whether it's friends or family, and I often wish that things didn't happen the way they did because of that. Even though I know I have friends and family there on a daily basis, it's hard to connect with people, and I feel completely alone a lot of the time because of it, even though those people are there, because I think on a subconscious level, I just stopped allowing myself to need people emotionally. Even though I want to need people emotionally, I find it that I can't. And I feel that long term, that's done more damage to me than if my parents had just tried to work it out, even if they got divorced, you know, tried to find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Well, one thing about it, Marcus, in your case, you're very good at expressing yourself. So You can take that as an advantage and a real strength in your efforts to meet and converse with other people. I'll just say that off. That's off the top of my head. I want to give Karen Bonnell a chance to comment. Karen?
Marcus, what a tough example of what we really hope to avoid. And I'm, first of all, just want to say I'm really sorry as a kiddo that you went through that. And you're absolutely right. It wasn't the divorce. It wasn't that your parents' spousal relationship needed to end. It was that they were unable to come out the other side and co-parent you and maybe your siblings through the rest of your childhood. And oftentimes, the way that we think about that, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to play in one of the lakes when there's big waves or out in the ocean, and you know that feeling if you go out in the ocean and you watch a wave coming, and you, as soon as it comes, you turn and it catches your back and it pushes you toward the shore. And that's an exhilarating and challenging, personally challenging experience to have. And divorce is like that under the best of circumstances. Children feel like they have to catch a wave at their back, and they're sort of forced through a family change that they don't have a lot of control over. But what happened for you is that other experience of standing out there in the ocean and waiting to catch that wave and misjudging, you know, in this sense, the wave was too high and it came over your head. And that feeling of, I'm going to take in water, I'm now spinning underneath the water, and not ever coming out whole again. And, you know, the work that you're doing, the way that you're expressing yourself, you're right on track. I really want to echo what Larry's saying, is you know that your heart's in there. You know you want to connect. And the guarding that you set up as a kiddo to protect yourself, you can take that apart when you're ready with some help, perhaps. You'll take that apart and get the connection that you want and need.
Marcus, thank you again, and certainly good luck to you now and in the future. I appreciate your call. I want to give Becky in Decorah, Iowa, a chance to join in. Becky, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I just tuned in, so I don't know if you've talked about this, but I was wondering, from the grandparents' point of view, I have a son that's going through a divorce, and with two small grandchildren, how can grandparents, what can they do?
Yeah, what's their role? Thank you. Very good point. A very good question, Becky.
Yeah, great question, Becky. And we do actually write some about that in the book, because these little ones, one of the hallmark senses of family, and what we hope for children, is that they don't lose their sense of family. And grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins are all an integral part of that sense of family that children know as they're growing up. And so what we ask of our grandparents and our extended family is to recognize all the ways that you can support the children as they go through the change without getting caught in taking sides, minimizing conflict and battles, and remembering that when the kids are with you, they get to think about something else. They don't need to be worried about their mom and dad. They don't need to be worried about their family change in this moment. And ideally, their parents are, of course, working to see and solve the problems of the family change so that ultimately, over the next year or two, things will stabilize again and the kids will feel securely rooted in both of their homes with each of their parents, and that they will have you, obviously, as a key player on their elbow and sense of support, whether that's at a soccer game or a school concert or obviously those visits on the weekends. So that's what we ask of our grandparents, is to remember that you're just as much an integral sense of this little one's family, and to continue to be grandparents. That's a blessing.
Yes, it is. Yep. Well, I thank you very much. That's helpful.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Your own questions or experiences to share, we'd certainly love to hear from you. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post your questions or comments there. You lay out some very good ideas for creating structure about communication between co-parents. I think that can be oftentimes a difficult thing for co-parents to communicate with each other. What are your recommendations there?
Right. Well, there's a couple of things that I'd like to just say about that, Larry, which is, one is, I always say to parents, regardless of separation and divorce, you're always 100% parents. But you're on duty as a parent a certain percentage of the time at very specific times that are based on your residential schedule. And that's one of the first guidelines around communication, is recognizing, am I on duty or am I off duty? If I'm at the soccer field and my daughter Madeline is playing soccer and her siblings are there at the game and their other parent is there and is the duty parent that particular day, then I am going to remember that in communicating with my kids, if they come over to me and they say, hey, can I go to the snack shack? I'm going to say, hey, you need to go back over there and ask your mom. She's in charge today. If it's okay with her, she'll give you permission. So that kind of respect, that kind of sense of where are the boundaries, help our children figure out how to navigate the relationships with their two 100% parents, but now in two homes, one on duty, one not on duty. When it comes to co-parents communicating between themselves, we give some very specific protocols about how to use email, how to use text messaging, how to use face-to-face meetings to plan the business of their kids' lives. And as you notice, Larry, we use very much a business decorum.
Yeah.
We really try to help parents move into that mind of, hey, we're the CEOs and the CFOs of our children's life, co-parent executive officers, co-parent financial officers, and we're going to behave like we want this to be a well-run company. Because, you know, just unfortunately, if we were to, you know, get ourselves employed at a poorly run company, ultimately we would quit and go work somewhere else. But kids can't do that. They are going to grow up in this company called their family. And so it's incumbent on us to figure out how to do those two roles. How are we good decision makers, good problem solvers? That's our CEO. And how do we make sure that things are paid for in a timely way, maintain a good credit rating with each other so that our kids' lives can move forward? So all of that includes communication and those guidelines of how to do strong business communication are a part of that.
It can sound formal and awkward, but I there are good reasons for suggesting that kind of structure, really.
There definitely is, because keep in mind, particularly in that first year or two, we are working so hard to separate out what is our intimate partner feelings from the business of co-parenting. And so the more I can kind of slip into my business mind, I know how to do this at work. You know, when I was a nurse by training, and if I was working the floor back in the day and I was angry with one of my colleagues who maybe did something that I thought was, you know, inappropriate or inconvenient or whatever, I didn't go off at her in the nursing station. I simply said, that didn't work for me. You know, I moved into a skill set that we all have, but I think often forget to use in a co-parenting situation because it's so emotionally charged. And in some ways, because we think we have a license to fly off the handle. Well, on some level, maybe we do, but for our kids' sake, we don't want to. For our kids' sake, we want to do it different.
Very good points there. I'm wondering, one of the things that comes up, I'm sure, and I know, in every divorce kind of situation, is that there are going to be important events and important holidays, whatever the background of the family. And parents need to co-parent to work out a system that can work for everybody. That's got to be really difficult.
I think that the holidays in particular in the first couple of years, Larry, present some very difficult challenges. And I work closely with parents to figure out what can we do, what can't we do, what makes sense for the kids, how do we focus on them while at the same time honoring our own individual capacities to be in the same room. Most parents in the early stages agree that there are certain holidays that they can celebrate separately and do that better if they go ahead and celebrate those separately. But let me give you some examples of where parents often can come together. And one of those is a child's birthday. And we work with parents to try and imagine that hour and a half or so where one parent is probably throwing the birthday party, and we encourage parents to rotate that from year to year, who's kind of the project manager of the peer birthday party. But here they are, they have all their friends, and there's nothing more important to a kiddo than to have both their mom and dad or both of their parents, whether it's two moms, two dads, whichever, there to watch them, you know, to hear the song, to watch them blow out the candles, and to watch them open their gifts. That hour, hour and a half, very bookended period of time where you're focused on your child, you're there simply for him or her on her birthday, you know, most parents can do that, and it means the world to kids. Another example that's similar early on with young children, our fours, fives, and sixes, is parents often agree that for Santa gifts, if you celebrate the Christmas holiday, for Santa gifts, that the non-residential parent will come over at, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, whatever is your tradition, and stay for that hour, hour and a half again of just some easy gift-giving, have a glass of orange juice, cuddle your children, and then remind them that you'll see them again soon. But that moment of sharing for children is just their memory builders. So if we can do it, that's really useful. Over time, two home families become stable and they develop their own traditions. And it becomes less important in terms of holidays, begin kids settle in for holidays. We encourage parents to really be careful about splitting all the holidays, so that a child's sense of every holiday is, I spend half the Thanksgiving at my mom's, and then I spend half of my Thanksgiving at my other mom's, and I never get to settle in anywhere for a real Thanksgiving. I'm just busy transitioning. You know, we need to be careful about that. We need to be thoughtful about how we structure those.
Yeah, I can see that. And you, you have a chapter that talks about the child in a divorce or separation situation is in distress, the signs that a child is in distress. Can you share some of those with us?
You bet. You know, Chapter 2 is devoted to kind of the emotional landscape for children. And as I mentioned, Kristen Little, who is my contributing author, she's a child specialist. And she's done a beautiful job of just really helping parents know how do children grieve, because they tend to grieve differently than adults, grieving nonetheless, the change in their family. And there are certain times when we know kids might be actually getting into trouble with their grief. And what I mean by that is they're not actually moving through it. They're getting stuck. And we want to be able to recognize that. In young children, that is persistent temper tantrums. And when I mean what I mean by persistent is over the the next 2 or 3 months of adjustment, if we're not seeing things diminishing and kind of working through feelings, and kids are tolerating our support and the new rhythms and structure, we need to be aware of that. Our children, have they stopped sleeping well at night? Have they returned to persistent bedwetting? Are they acting out at school? Are their grades falling? Are they changing peers and gone from their usual suspects that they hung out with, their healthy set of peers that they used to have, and now they're kind of choosing children who are more on the fringe? And we begin to get worried. Or they're withdrawing and spending far, far, far too much time alone in their room, changing how they're dressing in a way that might be concerning. As we move into our teens, we really watch for signs of is anybody developing an eating disorder, or goodness forbid, cutting on themselves. These are all signs for teenagers of enormous emotional distress. So divorce doesn't cause this symptomatology. I want to be really clear about that. Divorce is not the culprit. It is when kids are feeling inadequately supported, trying to navigate the change of divorce. That's when we're going to start to see the kinds of things that we're more concerned about. Persistent, high conflict, having a parent being emotionally offline for too long or too deeply depressed or anxious, bad-mouthing parents persistently, or making the children feel guilty about openly loving a parent or sharing what they're doing at the other parent's household. That's going to cause kids to feel like that wave, just like we talked about with Marcus, that wave is coming too far over their head and they're taking on water.
You do make a point to say that kids who are raised in a co-parenting situation have the chance to develop positive skills that and abilities that maybe others don't.
Right. And this is just the other side of the coin. When children are adequately supported, some of the things that they learn while navigating this level of family change, they learn a lot about, first of all, how to grieve, how to move through feelings that they hadn't yet been challenged by. They watch adults solve problems that were very, very, you know, very big problems, very big emotions. They get to witness their parents move apart and come back together as co-parents, so move apart as spouses and come back together to take care of them. They are asked to make adjustments that, of course, are not typical in a one-house family. They are also required by the very nature of what we call tandem single parenting. You know, when I've got the kids at my house, I'm kind of a single parent on duty. And that's going to require me to ask a little bit more involvement by the kids. They're going to be a team of three at my house, and they're going to be a team of three at your house, Larry, where I'm going to say, hey, you know, where this might have been a place where your dad helped, I'm going to need to ask you to step up and take out the recycling. In a one-home family, two parents often compensate for kids and don't ask kids to do things that they're fully and age-appropriately capable of doing. That often shifts in a one-home family, and so these kids learn house management skills, they learn organizational skills, they learn transition skills, and the key there, again, is that we don't overwhelm children, but that we ask of them and we help them develop the skills that are very age appropriate for them, which actually results in them feeling confident and competent in a way that they may not have developed in a one-home family.
You know, Karen, yours was an important book for me because I'm actually now facing a divorce myself after 18 years of marriage, and I have an 11-year-old daughter. And so this is a very sad time for me. Of course, it's something you never expect. And I certainly want Emily to be sure that she grows up to be happy and healthy and that she suffers as little as possible from this. So thanks for your book. And I can say that as I read through your book, I realized that Renee and I, were already following a lot of the guidelines that you have written about in your book. And so I really appreciate it's something that will help me, and I'm sure it is going to help a lot of other parents. So thank you so much.
You are most welcome. And even Larry, if in reading it, it just gives you the confidence that you're on the right track. Again, it's that idea of that confident, loving guide. And if the book is kind of metaphorically a hand on your back and Leah's back, that's wonderful because, you know, again, that's what we're hoping for.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you all for listening, too. It's been a really tough show for me in some ways, but a good one, too. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.